Hey, welcome everybody to the Sharp Way Show. I'm so glad so many of you have given me a part of your evening to chat with me on this Friday evening. Yes, it's 7 p.m. on the East Coast, which means you got to look at my mug. That's kind of how it works. I don't make the rules. I do make the rules. I make the rules and I follow them. You need to be watching me at 7 p.m. That is the rules. And as always, please like, comment, and share. It does matter so that people see what we are doing. I am very lucky this evening. This evening, I have with me someone who's going to school us, or at least give us some cool stories, I hope, on psychedelics. It is one of the topics that is just big today. It's everywhere. He is from the Hudson Valley Psychedelic Society. Hope I got that right. The man himself, Daniel Grauer. How are you, sir?
I'm doing great, Larry. Thanks so much. I'm really excited to be here tonight. Appreciate you having me.
Awesome. And people who want more information, head over to, clearly it's obvious, www.hudsonvalleypsychedelicsociety.com. They went out of their way to make that special. I'm kidding. But any case, Daniel, you wrote a book. Tell me about that book.
Sure. So the book is called Psychedelic Consciousness, Plant Intelligence for Healing Ourselves and Our Fragmented World. The book is essentially a breakdown of where I think psychedelics can really fit into society.
Got it.
So I think over time, obviously, we're experiencing a multitude of crises right now that's happening in the world. What I break down in that book is I think it's actually a result of a deep disconnection from nature, from each other, from the results of our action. And I think over time, that's led to deep polarization. It's led to deep fragmentation and more or less continue to go down this very dangerous path that we're going down. And essentially, I think we're coming up upon a crossroads as a species. You know, are we going to identify and work with all of the issues that we're currently faced with and essentially elevate our consciousness and come together to address those issues? Or are we going to go down this continual, you know, kind of spiraling path towards collapse, which, of course, we hope doesn't happen? So what I talk about in the book is kind of how we got there, perhaps over time, how this ideology of disconnection, of fragmentation came about. And then bring in the topic of psychedelics, because I think, you know, not only are many of us hearing about the incredible research right now in terms of it being able to help treat depression, PTSD, anxiety, terminal illness, substance abuse disorders, and many other things. However, I think there's also a piece to talk about how they fit within the collective narrative and how they can essentially catalyze what I think is or I hope is a societal shift in consciousness. And the way I think that happens is getting to the core of this disconnection. And when you look at the psychedelic experience, typically what's happening is, you know, at certain levels of doses, there's some degree of ego dissolution. And when that happens, one typically experience some form of interconnection, some form of kind of classic oneness.
Well, people have said that they feel like this almost puts you in like a childlike, almost like when you were a kid and like the world had more wonder and things of that sort. Is that too simple or is that kind of true?
I think it's part of it. I would say it's a little bit too simple because, you know, sometimes when you're in those experiences, particularly if you're having kind of what's considered an authentic mystical experience, it is what feels like a very heightened sense of awareness, a sense of really, you know, unconditional love. And it almost feels as if you are, there is knowledge that is arising from within. And so I wouldn't necessarily say, you know, sometimes it's very childlike and, in a way, you know, I think when, you know, your ego dissolves and what they're seeing in terms of brain imaging studies is there's an increased amount of connection going on in the brain when this area that would be controlling it called the default mode network is kind of shut down a little bit. So increased connections are happening. So that's one thing that adds to, I think, that novel.
So let me touch that piece if I could. Sure. And the piece I want to bring up that is kind of personal to me in the way I'm a veteran. And I know many of the veterans who are coming back, particularly combat veterans, but not only combat veterans. I've had several on the show already. They come back with serious issues. And many of the issues are PTSD, but some are TBI. If there's, you know, TBI is traumatic brain injury that is often undiagnosed because our helmets and our armor is so good that we don't realize that there's been brain damage because it's not obvious until later. right? So we have some TBI and some PTSD, and sometimes both, right? Sometimes a combination, obviously, sometimes those things. Mm-hmm. And I know that about 1 in 5 Americans in general have some type of mental health issue in some way. Veterans are even higher. And then the suicide rate of people who have some mental health issue are far higher than someone who doesn't, right? The odds are far higher that you'll commit suicide or at least attempt self-harm, right? Mm-hmm. If you have some kind of mental health issue. And I feel like this is almost like a way that you can have, how do I explain? You said the ego. And the reason why I brought up is so many veterans, particularly combat veterans, they feel like, I don't need no help, right? I'm a tough guy. And they're right. They are tough guys. They just came out of a combat zone. That's an accurate statement, but it doesn't mean they don't need help, right? You can be a tough guy and still need help. And I feel like when an experience that I've heard of, I've never done, had the experience. I don't have PTSD from that time frame. I'm not a combat veteran, but the veterans I've worked with who've talked to me about it, they've said that when they do this, they actually, as you say, they kind of let go and they're able to actually talk through the issues with their therapist, or I guess a psychiatrist, I'm not sure, the medical professional, whoever that person is, and kind of walk through their PTSD and almost like, I'm going to use their words, so tell me if I'm wrong, but their words is like rewire their brain to kind of rewire the event. That's the words they've told me. Is that real or is that true or am I off on this?
No, I think you're spot on. So I think what's happening in the brain, or at least what the research is showing, is again, this default mode network that's kind of the seat of the ego that's controlling things. They think that perhaps in the case of PTSD or various other ailments that you mentioned, is almost individuals can get stuck in the way of their thought patterns, in the way that their neurons are connected to each other and keep on looping back into something. And so what they're finding that's very interesting is that when this default node network shuts down, mm-hmm. There is an opportunity, exactly like you're saying, to rewire. So that's what they're showing in terms of brain imaging studies. But in terms of subjective experience, psychedelics have been called non-specific amplifiers or awakening the inner healer, if you will. So, you know, perhaps what's going on is they're re-entering into that experience, seeing it from a different lens. And for whatever reason, whatever has the most energy inside ourselves that needs healing is coming up in this. And then we have a new perspective on it. And it is essentially mm-hmm. being rewired in the brain and from our subjective experience as well. And I just had a conversation with a dear friend of mine who is a veteran as well. And he was talking about this experience. And so you have the therapy model. And then you mm-hmm. also have people who are seeking this on their own. And, right. you know, we want to make sure that people have the right to do so. And in my friend's words, you know, he said, you know, after being out doing a few tours, you know, I don't necessarily want to be in an office. But I found that when I was able to have the confidence to work with myself and, let's say, work with mushrooms and be out in the woods in a very safe way and an intentional way, he was actually able to heal himself. So I just want to point out the validity of both sides. You know, for some folks, therapy is a great thing. But for others, I think it's important to address the right and the autonomy for individuals to be working with plants and mushrooms on their own, particularly because they're natural. But even if they're right, you know, have the right to do so. But I think you're very spot on that. Yeah.
Let me grab a couple of comments. Got people commenting here. Jennifer says, I'm a peer recovery specialist and recovering addict. I am all for psychedelics and how they can help treat trauma and people with opioid disorders. When I make it to graduate school for social work, I want to do my thesis on this very subject. She gives you a heart. So this is the second piece I want to bring up, right? PTSD is personal to me, obviously, but something else is. My mother was an addict and I was able to assist her with support and such things like that to get her back in action. Many of her peers were unable to do that. And I've heard more than once that psychedelics can almost in a way heal abuse to where people don't want to go back at all. But the thing that I heard, and please help me, I always assumed when I first heard this, that you always replace one addiction with another. So I always thought, right? And I know I'm wrong on this one, but I'm telling you what I thought. So I think other people think the same thing as I used to think. I think, okay, so you stop, you know, drinking, or you stop doing, you know, heroin. So now you just do LSD every day. That's what I thought. But I feel like I'm way off on this one.
Yes, I would say slightly off, and it's not a replacement thing for folks. Psychedelics are actually a non-addictive. They're not something that you can be physically dependent to. And you're accurate. There's incredible research. There's incredible anecdotal evidence and historical evidence that shows the capacity for psychedelics to help. Provide relief from substance abuse, particularly relating to opioids, should the individual be seeking it. And it seems to work in the similar kind of fashion as of what we were talking about in terms of the brain chemistry and being stuck in patterns, and kind of seems like shakes you out of it, or is able to, as you were mentioning, get to the root of some degree of trauma perhaps that was causing someone to continue to go down this path, because of course typically addiction is not necessarily related so much to the drug, even though it has the physical capacity. Sure. There's often a multitude of things going on as well. So I think that's kind of what we're finding here is with psychedelics is it helps you get to the core of the issue. And I can tell you from experience in terms of, the addiction matter, the experience itself isn't always, rainbows and butterflies, particularly if you're dealing with some deep trauma. It can be very, very challenging. It could be an incredible amount of work to face that stuff. And so although it's really important to have this respect and preparation and be supported during it and integrate afterwards, it's incredibly daunting sometimes. And so I think there's that element of itself where, again, physically they're not addictive, but it's also the experience can be very challenging. So I think for folks who work with it, sometimes you don't necessarily go, get excited to go into it. It is, you're saying, ah, I got to go into this deep healing. And it's there for that.
Yeah, I think the average person who doesn't know the field mixes up psychedelics and marijuana all the time in their heads, right? It's like the idea of it's the hippies from the 60s and they would smoke weed and take LSD. And, look, I got some gray hair. So, I understand how the older people think, right? So a lot of people, I think, still have that image, right? That image is still there. Oh, it's, you take LSD, it's like smoking weed. It's free love. And like almost like taking any type of psychedelic, to your point, to the opposite of what you're saying, the image is, oh, it's just people who just want to trip and get high. It's not about healing. It's just, oh, weed isn't enough for you anymore, so you now need LSD to get high. Isn't there still that stereotype or that negative stigma that still kind of holds on to psychedelics?
It's interesting. I've been really happy over the past, 16 years or so to really see a shift in the stigma related to psychedelics. But I think it's important to note and to point out, yes, they're incredible healing agents. They're incredible agents for spiritual growth, for personal growth. But they also can be very joyful, and they also can be very playful.
It's just us old people who think that way. Okay, it's fine.
Very fun. So I think it's important to point out sometimes it's not about healing, and I do just want to respect individuals' rights to be accessing something just for the sake of joy, as if it was something that we needed permission to do so. Like Brandon said, end the war on drugs. I agree for multiple.
Brandon's yelling, end the war on drugs. He's with you. Yep.
But in terms of cannabis, I think, that's also something obviously that we know could be used for incredible healing and spiritual benefit.
Sure.
And it can be used as a recreational pastime too. I think it's something that, perhaps gets used with a bit more regularity. And for folks who feel that's a good idea, of course, nothing wrong with that. I think we're looking at these are beautiful plants and mushrooms. And so long as we're doing them safely and not causing harm to anyone else, I don't see any reason why there should be a stigma surrounding their use.
There we go. Dave Martin says micro dosing for the win. So you got a fan here. There we go. Dave Lovett says, I've been stealth medicating since 1971. It hasn't been easy. This kind of goes to what you're talking about, right? Sometimes healing, it's not easy sometimes, right? It might take years to kind of get through some of the stuff, right?
It's not easy. Like we're saying, sometimes, and it depends on the avenue. Some folks are comfortable with therapy. Some folks are comfortable doing it in ceremony and community-based, supported models. Some people are comfortable doing it on their own. And we just want to support that. I think it's important to note, you brought up suicidal ideation and substance abuse and PTSD, and I also want to include depression in there. When we're talking about all those numbers combined, it's almost about 55 million Americans are suffering from that. So when this evidence starts coming out, of course, people have been working and medicating in this way, and I think we're going to see more and more people continue to do so. So, from my perspective, I think the perspective of many others, the idea that the government should be prohibiting individuals from accessing natural medicines, particularly when we have this large of a mental health crisis and an opioid crisis, for me is like way beyond rationality, way beyond dignity, is a total infringement upon our fundamental rights, and something I think needs to be changed immediately, as in this is an emergency, almost in the same way that we gave emergency use application to COVID vaccines. I think we need to be giving emergency decriminalization to natural plants and mushrooms to allow people the opportunity to heal themselves in a community supported, again, safe way, respect and prepare and support and integrate with these beautiful experiences. But this is massive, and this is incredibly important.
Well, I mean, states have already made mushrooms legal or decriminalized them, I should say. And Andrew Yang is talking about it. But Andrew Yang, who's running for those of you who don't know, mayor of my city, he absolutely is. And so far, the front runner. So it looks like he's going to be the mayor. He may not. That's just what it looks like today. It's politics. Next week, he might be out. But at the moment, he looks like he's the front runner at the moment. And he's openly about, and what I like is he's actually not saying legalize. He's actually saying decriminalize. And the average American doesn't know the difference. The average American does not know the difference between decriminalize and legalize. They think they're exactly the same. They see no difference in it. And most politicians also would never say decriminalize. They're all about legalize, regulate, hammer, get my cronies involved. And Yang is saying decriminalize. I guess I'm just kind of backing up what you're saying. The change is here, right? I mean, when I was a kid, nobody would have said that. I mean, that nobody would have said that when I was a kid. Now the mayor of New York is like, decrim. I can't believe it. It's surprising to me. But
Yeah,
I'm happy about it.
I'm incredibly happy about it too. It is definitely due time, and I think it's really important that you made that distinction between legalization and decriminalization. Often with legalization, like we saw with the recent passing of the MRTA, which is a beautiful piece of legislation, you're seeing you're creating a regulatory model.
Right.
There's a lot that's involved with legalization. Of course, when you get involved with commercial sales, there's a whole slew of complexity involved in terms of retail and distribution and where the money is going to and how it's taxed and where all of that's flowing and who gets the right to have licenses. It's a whole, there's a lot involved with that. However, in terms of decriminalization, you're simply saying it's not a crime.
Right.
And it's a lot, in my opinion, it's a lot larger of a freedom. So, what you saw in Oregon, you have the legalization of psilocybin therapy in one bill, and then the decriminalization of all controlled substances in another separate bill. However, I think it's very important that we speak to the need to, if there's going to be legalization, decriminalization should and needs to be happening contemporaneously, because if not, you're essentially blocking an access point for for those who can afford or have the time to access something like psilocybin therapy that's available. But if it's still a crime for the majority of individuals, that's going to be too cost prohibitive, and it's leaving out a large majority of our
Right.
civilization. Meanwhile, if you decriminalize it, then it's essentially in the same category of, let's say rosemary, as in my opinion, as it should be, because these are natural plants and mushrooms.
I used to,
Then,
when I ran for governor, I said legalize marijuana, cannabis like onions. I'm with you. Regulate like onions.
I'm completely with you. So in that case, folks have the opportunity to, again, to work with their communities, to work with community-based organizations that are already providing a lot of information and already providing a lot of support to their communities. And
so,
there's tons
so of I want to go to another question. It's similar. Brandon says, what kind of commercial market do you envision if they're legalized? If psychedelics are legalized, do you have an idea in your mind what it could or what it should be if we actually go, yay, let's do this?
Yeah, I think that's a really phenomenal question. Again, we spoke about the decriminalization bit, and in terms of a regulatory model, one of the best things that I've seen so far is something that Decriminalized Nature put out, which is a great organization that's been essentially working on municipal and state level, but they've worked to decriminalize through municipal level resolutions six or seven municipalities throughout the country. And they were working on an ordinance called OCHI, which is Oakland Community Healing Initiative. Okay. And what I loved about that is the support is on localized community regulation of these plants and how ceremonies are run. So it essentially creates a local committee, a local board, if you will, then folks can nominate themselves as facilitators, if you will, whether you're, you know, doing ceremony or you're a therapist.
So hold on. Would that mean that certain communities could kind of ban it and go, I don't want this stuff in my neighborhood? Are you saying that too or no?
I mean, you know, I'm for complete decriminalization of anything. I don't think anyone should have the right to be banning people doing any ceremony work or anything like that. But when we cross over into this category of legalization and regulation.
Yeah, that's my issue, right? That's what Brandon's talking about, right? Are we going to have it to where it's like at a farmer's market? Are we talking, or to your other worry, is this going to become a big business thing? Is Pfizer all of a sudden going to have, you know, their mushroom pill? And it's like, you know, to ask your doctor about Pfizer room or whatever is the cool thing they call it, right? Is that the future too? Do you think that happens?
Well, it's a really phenomenal question because I think we're coming up into that future right now. That is that discussion and what is going to happen is exactly what's happening. I mean, there's bills that are popping up in states all around the country, and the future of psychedelics is going to be written in the next few years. And granted, there's going to be multiple, as always is with policy shifts and things, even if it gets put in place, you still got to fight for something or another. But I think, you know, so long as we're focusing on the autonomy of, you know, communities to regulate themselves, you know, to be able to not only include therapists as facilitators, but people have ancestral healing and these ceremonies for tons of years, a part of cultures that have been working with it for thousands of years. And
again, a lot of Native Americans still, right?
Yeah, of course. Yeah. And all over indigenous cultures in South America and all around the world. So long as there's capacity for, you know, again, local, you know, regulatory models that could include that and yes, totally allow for the complete exchange, the complete sale of natural plants and mushrooms at a farmer's market. They're natural plants and mushrooms that should be absolutely allowed. And on top of that, in my opinion, if you want to have them in stores too, if you want to go through that whole process, great. If you want to go through the classic therapy model, that's great too. But there are large companies right now that are going and, you know, being publicly traded, and they're looking you know, produce either a novel synthesis of, let's say, psilocybin or, novel psychedelic compounds that are designed for a certain thing. That's all taking place as we speak. I know, I think the military invested some money about a year ago, you know, into some psychedelics that don't, quote unquote, have the side effects, which the side effects are the healing. That's kind of the whole point there.
Military is not worried about the healing part, my friend. That's the part they're not worried about. Right? That's their side effect. They don't care about that part.
Hopefully they want to heal veterans. I mean, I think that should be in the best interest, and I hope that's true. But yeah, it's going to be a very fascinating next few years, and you know, I'm all for people if you want to go do that way and that's something you find valuable, great. But again, let's make sure we're protecting everyone's rights.
Just mentioned protecting everyone's rights. There are still people who are afraid. And my two cents, she says or he says, I'm not sure if which I'll just say they. They said, how do you qualify it? Who should be on it? How about people like Edward Gallagher, the stories that are coming out about him? Could he be worse on this stuff? Do you see this as pushing off reality? And I do think you have a group of Americans who do believe this, right? Who feel, hey, wait a minute, you know, are we just adding another escape to America? Are we just adding another drug into our world, which we're already dealing with alcohol, we're already dealing with opioids? Do we want to add another one in? And I think my two cent has his question is one that many Americans are asking.
Yeah, I think it's really important to note when we're talking about the range of substances that when we're talking about psychedelics and particularly natural psychedelics, these are actually the least harmful to users and the least harmful to others of all of the substances that exist out there, most definitely including alcohol and tobacco. So we're talking about the amount of emergency room visits for psychedelics and compared to other substances is like 0.1. It's tiny without a very, very low harm potential. It is almost nearly impossible to overdose on LSD or psilocybin. So what we're talking about is what, you know, how do we quantify that? And essentially what we're talking about is, you know, if we phrase this in the way of tools, right? This is going to be zooming out a little bit to be very fundamental. There are multiple things in society that we use as tools, right? If there's a potential or potential value that tool has, we don't make it illegal, right? Because that tool has value. However, and this is going to be paraphrasing a great researcher named Stanislav Grof. If you look at a knife in the hands of a chef, a surgeon, and a murderer is a very different tool, but it's a tool nonetheless. And because that knife can be used by a murderer, does not mean that we automatically outlaw that knife because someone can use that to be harming someone. If we did, pretty much every single thing in our reality would be made illegal. Water could be used to drown people, but fire can burn. I mean, we're talking about, this is a very, you know, fundamental question here. So why, particularly something that's natural, it for me, and even leaving outside the fact that it's incredibly low harm compared to other substances and various other tools that we use on this earth, you can say that you might not prefer someone to do that, but I might not prefer someone to do something else. It doesn't mean that's a crime. And it doesn't mean that everything doesn't inherently have risks in it. Of course, there is the possibility for risk in a psychedelic experience. There's a possibility for an adverse psychedelic psychological reaction that could be rather challenging. However, when these plants and mushrooms, these substances are brought to the light, what we're seeing is the more information that's out there, like with everything, the safer everything becomes. So if you're, again, respecting, if you're preparing, if you're supported, if you're integrating, which, to be honest, for the past, you know, I mean, thousands of years, these plants and mushrooms have been used safely. And even in America, after they became illegal, you more or less had a self-regulating community that was safe by providing this information out there. So even while it's been done in the dark, there aren't many reports of issues of public health risks or safety risks, or, you know, again, there's risk inherent to everything, but
we're really, I think you got numbers. I think Myron's in. Myron says, who's holding?
Yeah.
So I think Myron's in. You got him. He's on board. I'm not know what this means. Maybe you do. I think it's pronounced Moika Baud says Treasure Coast changed my life. Does that mean something to you?
I don't know what Treasure Coast is.
I don't either. So I hope it's cool. I thought it was a good thing.
Yeah, so, I'm happy you changed their life.
I'm glad your life was changed. I hope it was, Nancy says, the government did its job. It took us away from knowledge and enlightenment. Ouch. Look at you, Nancy. I think she's right, though. It's fine. She's still right. It's absolutely true. Yes. Brian says, my first and only experience with shrooms was a bit underwhelming, but the number of military TBI-induced migraines by about half. Oh, that's amazing. I'm happy about that.
Yes.
That's awesome.
That's another element that we're finding in a lot of research and anecdotal reports is that cluster headaches is a particularly challenging problem for a lot of individuals that, to my knowledge, does not have great modern medicine to be able to treat it. And there's a lot of encouraging results about psychedelics being able to help with cluster headaches.
Yeah, and I know again, from I know not many vets, I work with vets, TBI helps, right? And the sad part about TBI, from many people who don't know that, is we often don't know it's happened until sometimes months later. Like, we don't know that it's happened. Then we go, oh, that's from when, yeah, oh, okay, now we got it. And all of a sudden, we're like, oh, that's why I've had these migraines. That's why I've had these problems. That's why, you know, literally I black out for a couple hours all of a sudden. Oh, that's the reason why. Because I was, when the mind went off 6 months ago, now I get it. So I'm happy that this has been working for a lot of veterans, and they've been doing it, like you said, underground. They've been doing it underground, and it's been working.
Exactly. So, underground, you know, either they're flying to places where it's legal, they're doing it underground, they're seeking ceremony, you know, it's happening. Absolutely. And it's important that we allow folks to.
Dave says, yup, like herbs and tomatoes at the grocery store. And make it affordable to get the amounts needed for medical conditions. Dave's all in.
Dave, I'm with you. The beautiful thing about psilocybin mushrooms is you can grow your own. And I think once it's decriminalized, everyone should be growing their own medicine, as, you know, for so many things we've been able to access for a long time. It should be very reasonable and possible to access these things for people of all financial situations.
I think we want to, I think the government should be giving us the information required so that we can make our decisions how we want to make our decisions. I think the government should allow you to give information as you see fit so that we can make our decisions. And with that in mind, I'm going to do a quick commercial, guys. You know what I want you to do? I want you, because I know I want you to go ahead to our protest and civil disobedience survey. You know that the advocates.org are my sponsor. So do me a favor, click that link, take that survey. It's about 5 minutes. When you're done taking the survey, share it. Let them know. Keeps my sponsors happy. I can't do the show without sponsors. So take that survey, share it, let people know. Let them know what you think. And also you find out what other people think. So are you like the weirdo, or are you like in line? You're probably all weirdos. It's fine. Don't worry about it. Do that. It's good. And if you have some cash, head over to patreon.com/shortway. Support the show. You got 10 bucks, throw it my way. You're making a bunch of money. You got Biden bucks coming in. Throw me $100 a month because you got tons of money. Do that. If you don't have tons of money, no worries. Take the survey, or you can just like, comment, share. That's free. So you can help out either way. Keep the show going. So sorry about that, Daniel. I got to pay bills too. So I'm saying.
You got to do it, man. You got to pay bills
too. Absolutely. So Wade says, Pfizer would lace their versions with agents that counteract the positive effects and then offer a second medicine to relieve the use of the manufactured symptoms. That's, you know, I wish that wasn't true. I mean, isn't there some, I mean, you don't have to attack Pfizer. I don't want to put you in a bad spot, Daniel, but that kind of stuff is kind of based on something real, isn't it?
Oh man, I don't know. It's tough to get into the mindset of, you know, it's such a wild pharmaceutical corporation like that. I feel so far distanced from that I can't even fathom what's going on in their minds. And of course, there's always the underlying motive of profit, and sure, you know, when you include that.
And this is a good point. Is there government propaganda? Right. I know there has been throughout history government propaganda against weed, government propaganda against psychedelics. Right. Is the propaganda government based? Is it big business based? Neither, both. I mean, you have to have been, you have to sometimes go on the internet and just want to pull your hair out when you see some of the stuff that's happening. You just want to throw up on the screen. Right. I mean, when you see some of the stuff, I see it too. And to be forward, when I was a youngster, I believed some of it. Hmm. I did. I believed some of it too, right? I was a Marine in the 80s, right? I was a Marine when my first commander in chief was Ronald Reagan, Mr. Just Say No, right? So I have some of that in my head too, if that makes sense, right? I still have some of that in my head also. So it must drive you crazy. Do you think is this society? Is this Nixon's ghost, you know, getting us? What's your two cents in the propaganda?
Yeah, I mean, it might be Nixon's ghost. Who knows exactly what? Fortunately, I don't think that there's been too much propaganda coming out recently. It's actually been really incredible to see the acceptance across the board, certainly by the media, Even the FDA MAPS, Multidisciplinary Association for Psychedelic Studies, is in phase 3 trials with the FDA. So I haven't seen too much propaganda recently. Although of course we know that that propaganda that was put out, that Just Say No, the drug war itself, which was, as we know, founded and incredibly racist, incredibly harmful, incredibly ineffective.
Absolutely.
There is not one metric that it has achieved its success, and the metric should have, if it was reducing harm, reducing abuse, and reducing
anything,
it's done the complete opposite.
Yes.
When we say Just Say No, it murders people. I think probably the largest dangers with drugs in general is misinformation, information about how to keep yourself safe when using those drugs. It's drug impurity, which is absolutely the result of the drug war. If you're trying to cut it with something, if you're trying to, outrun, we see this in the psychedelic market, and we saw it with MDMA. When you outlaw something, you keep on making a novel, synthetic alternative. And it's this cat and mouse game. And every single time that they make something illegal or they catch up to it, there's 15 more chemicals that pop up that we haven't researched yet. And it totally gets crazy. And so we're just pushing it to more and more impurity. And so that's obviously a massive danger. And then the harm of being arrested itself. Arrest is incredibly harmful, incredibly dangerous. And if you're talking about being incarcerated, you're talking about actually being charged, it's brought into so many issues, employment, voting rights, services, all of these things. So by and large, of course, I think as so many folks are finally talking about, it's the drug war itself is incredibly more harmful than drugs. And if it were completely removed, and if we were moving to more of a harm reduction perspective, if we were moving to just a public safe, a basic humanity and dignity and compassionate and just and liberated process, what we would be doing is saying, how do we keep these individuals safe as possible? If it's their personal choice, drugs, that's their personal choice. How do we keep them safe? How do we reduce harm? If they want to receive treatment, how do we help them get that treatment? And of course, as we're seeing for folks who have decriminalized and ended the drug war, or not completely, but in Portugal,
absolutely,
it's not only they've saved tons of lives, they've also saved tons of money, as they'll tell you. It's incredibly more cost effective to treat someone than it is incarcerate someone.
Jennifer's on your side.
Yeah, when you break into all the details of this, it's almost mind blowing and boggling and just so insane. You can't really find one piece of data, one piece of evidence, or one piece of ration.
There is one.
What you got?
It makes a whole lot of money for people.
Yeah, I guess if you're in the prison industrial complex.
Yeah, 100%. So it does make money for some people, but I'm not okay with that. Nancy says, never had one patient ever addicted to psychedelics, worked in healthcare for 30 years.
Yeah, it's near impossible.
Wow.
It really happened. I don't even know how you would categorize that. Fortunately, so many incredible, mental health care professionals and nurses and doctors are coming out in support of this. And I just had a great conversation with the ex-police chief of Albany earlier this week. And we were talking about psychedelics, and he expressed that all of his time working there, there was psychedelics are not a public health concern. It's very, it's very rare that there is any sort of interaction. There's any sort of calls that way.
By the way, if everyone's interested in this, you can head over to the website, HudsonValleyPsychedelicSociety.com, and check them out. Can they get your book there, or is there someplace else to get your book?
To get my book, you can get it on my website, DanielGrauer.com, or you can find it in, Barnes & Noble.
And that's how you spell his name right there, Daniel Grauer, right there.
Yeah, thank you.
Spell it right there.
Check that out. Inbound, Amazon, a whole slew of bookstores. So thank you for pointing that out. But
absolutely,
would love to highlight some of the work the Psychedelic Society is doing in terms of providing advocacy and education and community support. And this is something that, again, you talk about kind of self-regulated community. You have organizations all around the country that are offering information out there, that are offering support in the way of helping, you know, we're providing community integration circles.
I love that. Hold on. Missy literally asked that question. Missy says, I've never experienced LSD because I was terrified I'd have a very bad negative trip. She says, I have severe PTSD. Would there be a hypothetically a specialist in psychedelics that I could go to for help? Now, Missy doesn't live in New York. Can she still go to Hudson Valley and still talk? And can she still, does it help if she's not in the area?
Well, unfortunately, I wish that we could be, you know, pointing to folks that offer, you know, these kind of services. But at this point in time, it's currently illegal. So it's not something that as an organization that we can encourage. It's not something that we can provide, which is crazy. Of course, we're always happy to provide information. We're always happy to provide, you know, how to keep yourself as safe as possible. We're offering from a great organization called DanSafe. That's been providing harm reduction for many years, sales drug testing kits. That's a possibility. And yes, we're always happy to, if there's individuals who have had a previous experience, you know, to join us in our integration circles to help kind of process it and bring it into your day to day and kind of help you work through it. However, it's very unfortunate that there are so many individuals who are seeking this and seeking either through a therapist or through, you know, again, kind of community-based healing. And it's totally a shame that it's currently illegal.
Yeah. Chaz says, any substance can be used for good things or abused for bad things. You are right that the potential for abuse of psychedelics is much less compared to legal drugs like alcohol and cigarettes, and scientific studies support this. So you got some fans here. So it's working.
Yes. Yeah.
It's good. So yeah. I guess the place where I want to go to is you mentioned MDMA. Mm. And I know MDA, I don't know the details, but I know it's like different compared to, I guess, psilocybin, right? It's different than that, right? And different than like DMT or LSD. Isn't it like different than those? I feel like it is. Am I wrong?
Yeah, it's slightly different. And there's definitely a lot of there's been a lot of healthy debate over time, and if it should be included as a psychedelic or if it should be included as a empathogen.
Okay.
Or if it's, you know, more closely related to kind of the amphetamine family, which chemically it is. However, the experience, you know, can be very psychedelic. So they're
okay
together. It is definitely working slightly different in terms of the way that it's binding to certain neuroreceptors and things along those lines. So yeah, it's kind of tough. It's like, classically, is it technically considered a psychedelic? You know, it depends who you ask. Psychedelic, for, you know, kind of stands for or it means mind or soul manifesting.
Okay.
The word itself is not, you know, necessarily a technical medical or scientific term. So, you know, things could be brought in together. But yeah, certainly you can have, you know, quite a visual experience, let's just say through MDMA. And so I think they often are compared together. And of course, what we're seeing in terms of MDMA being able to treat and provide relief from a similar range of ailments that the classic psychedelics are also showing as well. So they're typically,
I know people are using MDMA and then having a therapist then walk through their issues to kind of deal with PTSD is one thing I heard, at least, that yeah, they've been using it for that.
Yep. And that's currently where MAPS is at in terms of their phase 3 trials with the FDA. It's very much focused.
But psychedelics, aren't they still on Schedule 1 like marijuana?
They're still on Schedule 1, which is absolutely crazy.
We're using it for PTSD and then Schedule 1. I don't get that.
It's totally backwards. And it's, you know, I think for to be a Schedule 1, just so everyone's aware, I think the terms are, it can have no medical benefit and a high level for abuse. Those are the two categories to be on Schedule 1. Obviously, in terms of everything that we're talking about, like thousands of years of evidence of the medical benefit. Now, at this point, I don't even know what we're looking at, 60, 60 plus years of research that that proves it, even though there was a gap of time in between them, tons of anecdotal evidence. So
yep.
I think we not only, it's very important that you mentioned it, because not only should we be talking about decriminalization on the municipal and the state and the federal level, we should be just be talking about descheduling.
Yes,
that's obviously
absolutely
clear. And it's difficult because there's a lot of pathways to get there, right? There's a lot of pathways to get this done. As I mentioned, there's like the decriminalized nature style resolutions that have passed in many cities around the country. At the Hudson Valley Psychedelic Society, we've been working with Decriminalized Nature New York and a ton of organizations to introduce these municipal level resolutions, which are essentially, it's a deprioritization and a defunding. So you're saying the city now says it's the lowest law enforcement priority, that it will not use funds in the arrest and investigation of these matters. And then you call upon the local district attorney to cease prosecution. And then it calls upon state and federal legislators to take action towards decriminalization. So it'd be incredible if we can just go from the top down and just say, deschedule. This is totally insane. But at the moment, what we're seeing is, as often is the case, you have to go from the bottom up. And the bottom up is being generated right now by an incredible grassroots movement that is all generated by people saying, guys, this is absolutely insane and we need to change change it through the democratic process. And so, yeah, what we're seeing is in a lot of situations, it's starting at the municipal level, then it's moving up and the state legislators are going, whoa, this is actually something that our constituents really care about. And so I think there's 10, don't quote me on this, maybe there's 10 state level bills that have some sort of reference to psychedelic decriminalization.
Yeah, it's much more popular.
Yeah, so that's absolutely happening at the state. And I'm hoping that clicks at the federal level quite soon. And this is moving at a rapid pace, which has been incredible to witness. I mean, you know, cannabis took quite a long time in its trajectory to get done. But it's seeming like, you know, psychedelics are kind of right behind cannabis. And it seems like within the next few years, we should be looking at some pretty comprehensive change.
We have to have more people who get this in the executive branch at the highest level. I mean, the one that shocked me the most actually was Obama. I had hoped that W. Bush would have actually pulled it off of Schedule One because he had smoked weed and done cocaine himself. So I thought he would have pulled it off. He didn't. I thought Obama had to. Come on, Obama was the weed king. Obama had done everything. I thought he was going to pull it off. No. I hope Trump was. Trump had Kardashian show up, right? He had Kanye West in the White House. Okay, Trump's going to pull it off. No. And I thought, okay, now Biden. Come on, he's got to. He's got to feel that he felt bad for the crime bill of 94. So he's got to make it up by pulling off a schedule, right? No. But he's literally like punishing people in his own cabinet and his own, you know, organization who smoked weed in the past. Like, he's not even taking weed off. So you're going to take your psychedelics off? And of course, the vice president's the top cop who prosecuted people for this. So I don't think that's going to happen either. And I'm so disappointed. All they have to do, all any of them had to do was just go, you know what? It's off Schedule One. Executive order. Gone. So all they have to do. No one would have fought them. I'm sorry. Some people who have a certain constituency would have pretended to fight them so they could look good in front of their constituents. That would have happened. There would have been some symbolic evil drugs. There would have been some of that. But none of it would have been harsh. It all would have gone away and all would be gone now. And they just won't do it. And it's very frustrating for me. Very frustrating.
It's incredibly frustrating. And the
shaved dog's butt says the drug war now hurts us all, rather than just the poor and marginalized. I think that's true. It's so bad, it doesn't just hurt the poor anymore.
Yeah, I think it's hurt all of us. I think it's disproportionately affected the poor and communities of color the most substantially, as we can see through tons of evidence, disproportionate arrests and incarceration. But of course, it affects us all. I like the Students for Sensible Drug motto. The war on drugs is war on us. And
ooh, yeah,
it's really important to point that out. And Again, the government is supposed to be for us. So I think anyone who is listening to this, reach out to your local politicians at the municipal level and state level and the federal level and let them know that you want to end the drug war. It is mind-blowing how much of us care about this and how few of us, including myself for many years, did not just directly engage in the democratic and political process. Just email them. You know, the second hundreds of thousands of millions of people say you guys are crazy, end the drug war, they're going to start to do it, or they're not going to continue to be voted into office. So something I am just deeply encouraging. And yeah, I hope it can happen soon. I hope we get out of this, you know, complete insanity, and we look back on this as one of the strangest cautionary tales of something not ever to do.
I hope so.
And it's not only the descheduling, it's not only the complete decriminalization, it's also as something really identifying the harm that was done and working to remedy the harm that was done.
Sure.
And that's something that's been proposed in a lot of legislation, and something that was addressed in the MRTA, you know, in terms of...
I agree completely. Yeah. Right? Lori says, great show. Thanks for your research. Look at you. So you're getting a thank for your research. I like that. Myron is mad at me. He said, I can't call it MDMA. I got to call it Molly. Sorry. Got to call it Molly. Sorry, Myron. Don't be mad at you. Jeff says, psychedelics are in no way addictive, and anyone who says so is ignorant. Trust me, I know a thing or two because I've seen a thing or two. All right, Jeff. I'm with you, man.
Me too.
With you. Yes. Jennifer is going to look you guys up. So that's good. Jennifer, just go to the show notes in either Facebook or YouTube. I put all the links there. You can get his book in that link too. You can check it all out. It's all in the links for those of you who want to get some more information or want to, you know, check out what's going on. Please, it's all there. I put it there on purpose. So Brandon Lopez says, caffeine needs to be Schedule 1 then. Yes, as I have my coffee.
Brandon, yes. I think that's great, man. No, I'm just kidding. I actually compare psychedelics to coffee in my book too.
Is that right?
I love that Brandon talked, you know, brought that up. We're just talking about a naturally occurring substance that in some way, you know, affects our biochemical process that in some way helps us function. It's an altering. Like, caffeine is a psychoactive substance, and collectively as a society we have agreed that it's an okay psychoactive substance, perhaps because it leads to productivity and efficiency, or you know, whatever you know reasons one wants to say, or it just feels good, whatever the reason. But it's the same exact thing. We're talking about a natural psychoactive substance that some people think has value to be integrated into their life, and they should as no differently.
There we go.
And there's risks,
I love it.
There's risks of caffeine use as much as there's risks of psychedelic use.
And I remember when I ran for office, this is an interesting story. Mm-hmm. I ran for office for 18 months, so about a year and a half, and I was hopped up on caffeine and protein most of the time. But I believed, like an addict, that I could just come off coffee. But there were times when I was campaigning so much that I would have about 9 cups of coffee a day. That's how much I was having, because I would do so many events and I'd have to be up and awake and active and then still study. And then it was insane what I had to do during this campaign. So I was having that much. So when the campaign ended, I thought, I'll just stop coffee. Oh, that didn't work. That was not a good idea. But I thought I could do it. Oh, come on. I'm not addicted. Daniel, I can stop anytime I want, right? That's what I thought. And no, I literally had to wean myself off of coffee because I couldn't function without it. Like, I couldn't function without it because I had spent so much time drinking so much coffee. And some people probably listening and watching right now were on the campaign with me, and they would watch me. I would chug coffee. I had about 9 cups a day. It was that or I couldn't go on. I was crossing the state for a year and a half. So I just did it. And man, coffee's a drug. That's correct.
Larry, I gotta give you credit, man. That whole process seems incredibly daunting. The campaign process and being so needing to be so on and giving, you know, nonstop, particularly on tour, on the go. That sounds like Talk about a daunting experience. And life is sort of somewhat akin to, I'm sure you're experiencing varying altered states of consciousness in the midst of that process and just cranking through and giving it your best, man. So I give you a lot of credit.
Thank you, my friend. I appreciate that. Well, the problem is being third party, you can't make a mistake because any mistake you make is magnified 4,000 times. Right. If the two major brothers make a mistake, it's whatever. I make a mistake, it's magnified 75,000 times. So I've got to be on like 24/7, just crazy. So yes. Wow. So anyway, Jennifer says, Brandon Lopez, no, please don't take my caffeine away. I'm with you, Brandon.
We're not taking anything away.
if they put caffeine on schedule one, I'm an outlaw. That's it. I'm an outlaw. That's it. I'm going underground. Man.
Anyone should have the right to be working with whatever substances they desire to be. It's your choice.
There we go. Paula says, thanks for doing the show. No one wants to touch this topic. It's one of the reasons why I want to touch it, because I think the only time you see this topic being shown usually is like a panel or a debate, or it's not just the average person watching. It's like a TED Talk or something. Not even that. It's like an academic thing where only the academics see this. But I want the average person to see this. I want the average person, because I know there are people who are still either scared or worried or don't get it or don't see the value of it. And there's people who are like, I'm on board. Oh, my God. And when those two get together, I think that's when we have really good change. Good change.
I'm completely with you there. And it's been incredible to witness again over the past few years. I mean, when I first started writing about this stuff, I was like, ooh, this is kind of risky here to take this on. I'm really, I don't know, this could be dangerous for my career. But as I sat through the writing process, I said, hey, this is truth. This is something that I find truthful and very important. And I got to put it out there and take the risk of doing it. So I really appreciate you also, you know, putting yourself out there and saying, hey,
we need to
be talking about this stuff.
100%. I say all the time, the Liberty Movement is about life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. And people have to pursue happiness. And the other two parties don't talk about happiness. They talk about their level of control to control the issues that they care about. And I'm like, no, I want you to care about the issues that you care about. And if that includes psychedelics, good on you. And if not, also good on you. Just leave other people alone. That's all. Just leave the other people alone.
I'm completely concerned about it.
So let me ask you, before you wrap this up, Daniel, is there something that I missed or that you want to bring up or something from your book you want to bring up before we wrap this up? Anything?
No, I just, you know, again, I just want to say thank you for having me on here. I want to say thank you for all the folks listening and you know, if you were into it, great. If you weren't, you know, for having an open mind. And again, you know, I speak about all of this very positively, in my opinion, for good reason. And if you are going to enter into an experience, please just make sure to, you know, as I mentioned, prepare for it, respect it, do a lot of as much research as possible, take in as much information. If you can have folks there to support you, that is great. And, you know, for people to be there and integrate afterwards, incredible. You know, again, we're talking about this, it's at some points kind of objectively, but the experience in itself can be very transformative. Could be very, very powerful in the most incredible ways, and as we mentioned, sometimes very challenging. So I think it's just very important. Let's just, you know, to stay safe out there and make sure to take care of each other. And I think all of this is really in an incredible way. It's rooted in community. It's rooting in, you know, becoming increasingly connected to each other and the natural world and taking care of each other. And, you know, I think in the next however many years, we're coming up on an incredible amount of challenges. The more we can work together and the more we can work towards healing and working together as communities to build resilience and, you know.
That's the answer, community and resilience. I completely agree.
That's it.
Yes. For more information, please head over to HudsonValleySpsychedelicSociety.com. It's in it. It's in the notes. Please go ahead and check that out. And guys, please like, comment, and share. It does matter. And if you want his book, that's how you spell his name. Daniel Grauer, right there. DanielGrauer.com. Check out his book. Pick it up if you like it. And if not, give it to somebody who they might like it. It's a good gift. You could do that too. All good. And of course, feel free to head over to patreon.com/sharpway. Support the show if you like what I'm doing. Help me out. Throw me 10 bucks a month so I can keep doing this type of thing. So I can keep my staff going. So we keep doing something. And remember, if you click on the Linktree link here, this is not just here. It's also in Sharpway Clips on YouTube. We got a TikTok. We can put stuff on TikTok now. I don't know how, but we'll do it. And also, we also have this as a podcast. You can just listen to it while you're doing work or playing. I don't care. Your boss doesn't have to know. Put the AirPods in and pretend like you're working. And listen to what we're talking about now and tell your friends. It absolutely is a good idea. Guys, I want to say thank you so much for listening this evening. And thank you, Daniel, for coming on today. I will see you.